Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Shutt. Happy to have my friend John Binks with me here today. John, how are you, sir?
Doing great. I appreciate you inviting me today. This is awesome.
Man, really, really appreciate you making the time. I know you're very busy. Just so everybody knows, before we get going today, we're really talking about how do you manage up and manage technical deployments in highly political environments, as well as some other really fun stuff. John, so for everybody that doesn't have the opportunity to know you yet, do you mind just telling folks a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here, man?
Yeah, happy to. So, years ago, I was in the military, and after I got out of the military, started working for the government. And for the last 14 years, I've been working within DHS over at FEMA, and I was very fortunate to be able to have a very unique role, which was the chief of IT management. So I kind of oversaw all the technology that was coming in and out of the agency, to include the budgets that were related to it. And I'll tell you, it was really an amazing experience because you're in disaster modes, throughout half the year, so to speak, and then you have the shiny objects that come around. You have all these things that kind of come in and out, and you would imagine in that space within the federal government. And then, of course, after that, for the last couple of years, I've been real fortunate as well to work for a company in Reston, Virginia, Titan Technologies. They do system integration, real good people. And I'll tell you that the one thing that I've always seen is that connection between what mission space is and what companies that recognize that. So I got real fortunate over at Titan. And then, kind of in my free time, I write books on technology. I go out and give presentations. And real fortunate this year, I'm for if you're anybody that's familiar with the and I'm sure you are. The Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I'm one of the official judges this year in January. So I'll be out there judging the technology. So very fortunate. And again, I'm real happy to be here with you, Nick.
That's awesome, John. Really fantastic career. You've done a lot of really, really interesting stuff, and also worked in a lot of very political environments over the years, as working in the government is, and having led both in government and industry, man. When you hear the term managing up, what does that really mean to you in both of these worlds?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the first thing that I like to do is just kind of think of, what's like a tangible example, right? You can't make this up, right? Locally here in the Washington, D.C. area, there's a news channel that everybody listens to, WTOP, one of the, and so I remember one day, my boss, who was a political appointee, was listening to the local news channel as he was driving to the office. And at that time, AI, AI, AI. So I get to my desk. Next thing I know, boss calls me up, says, "Hey, John, yeah, this AI thing is real popular. Yeah, run down to Best Buy, buy me an AI." Click. And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, okay, that's not exactly how this works, right?" So I'm thinking, "Oh man, okay, I need to start understanding it and researching this concept of managing up, right?" So that's how it kind of started for me and the journey that I've kind of gone down the path with. And of course, there's the opposite of that, right? The managing down, right? Because all of a sudden, the boss is having the department put in some AI stuff, and robots are going to take over my job now, and those kind of things. So you have to kind of manage both ways. But I think the biggest thing that I've seen within the government versus industry on that is, the government is focused on the alignment with what their mission space is, the predictability of what they're doing. And a lot of times in industry, it kind of focuses on, speed and measurable results, that type of thing. There's no secret to it, right? The government works at a slower pace than what industry works at because they have two different mission sets. If a company does something really quick and it fails fast, it impacts that one company. Right. If the government does that, and the government does it to some degree, but you need to manage risk. But when the government does it, it might impact, all of America. So, the requirements are a little bit different there. But I see those all the time. But there's commonalities, though, right? Now, is that ability to kind of, you want to remove friction, you want to simplify the choices for the leaders, you want to be able to simplify the choices in industry as well.
Yeah, man. So when you ran down to Best Buy, which AI did you buy?
Yeah, I know, right? It's like, the shiny
Of
one. I bought the shiny object one, right?
course, absolutely, man. And how do obviously there's the mission space, but how do political reality shape technology adoption inside big agencies, these large agencies with large missions.
Right. Politics is huge, right? And it's huge for a lot of reasons. And one of the reasons is it kind of sets the tempo. One of the things that it does is the tempo could be the budget cycles. I mean, we've all kind of heard on the back end, at the end of the year, you got to spend money or you're going to lose it. Look at the front of that, right? When you're sitting there preparing to do some type of a technology deployment, some type of a technology upgrade, performance, you have to start thinking years out. The budget cycle is a 4 to 5 year cycle. So what I want today and what I need today, I would have had to have thought about it 5 years ago and gotten approval for it 4 years ago. And that is difficult, right? When we're sitting here, I mean, we weren't talking about, ChatGPT 4 or 5 years ago. So now it's, when you look at that, you have to think of the budget cycles. And you also have to think about how the leadership turnover goes. Without question, there are projects, that are very large projects that take multi-years to be able to do. So you have a new administration that comes in, and new administration always brings in, sub-administrations, right? So you have the White House that goes in, then you have different political appointees, different senators, different congressmen that all have different agendas, different cabinet members. And one of the things that I've always seen is that they'll come in, they'll see what's going on, and then, within that first 90 days, they'll say, okay, the battleship in this agency is going to point this way, and this is what we need to accomplish. Now, mind you, it takes 4 to 5 years to have gotten funding for that, right? So it's almost like, well, if we knew you were going to be here 4 or 5 years ago, that was going to be your thing, we would have started, funding that. However, that's the direction. So that's the direction that you're going to go. And then by the time these things start getting their feet moved, you're just getting into a pilot phase, and then a new administration comes in, somebody retires. And I'm not just talking about people that are elected officials or politicals. It also goes down to the folks that are a little bit lower down that chain, your senior executives that are doing certain mission spaces and certain battle spaces. That's always changing. And then I think the third thing, as far as the political aspect of it, is the public visibility. Because what you do has impact on the public, but they also wonder, and with today, right, everybody's got Twitter and everything else that you can just get stuff out really quick. When things are not the way people might want to have it, or things are not going as smoothly, or budget overruns or delays in schedules, it looks bad on the visibility of that to the public. And then the public, of course, rightfully so, because it's the government, it's the public money. They start, demanding, well, what's going on, and why are we kind of leaning this way?
Absolutely. No, I'm sure. I'm sure. And especially in let's just say the divisive environment that we're in right now, as it relates to politics, it has to be hard, when a new administration comes in and they want to cancel a whole bunch of stuff that the previous administration did. And there seems to be a lack of continuity with political direction in a lot of ways. We both know FEMA's not had a great year this year, for a lot of reasons. And yeah, it's just like it really has to be tough. I know I like. As on the contractor side, I've had work canceled in 17. I had work canceled in 17 and 21 and this year,
Right.
which is that flow down of this is just no longer a priority for us in the agency that we're working with. And a lot of that's politically driven. How do you like navigate that internally, with such that, broadly changing priorities from a political perspective?
From a political perspective, I kind of look at it as that, the leaders are, they're not resistant to innovation, right? They're resistant to surprises. They want to be able to kind of manage things. They want to be able to kind of understand that. I think from a leadership perspective, I think that one of the things that we need to do is really work on de-risking, right? Have a narrative of de-risk. So whatever you're working on and this kind of stuff, you're able to show all the stakeholders that you've done everything you can to mitigate those risks. Some ways that you can do that, start with a small pilot as an example. You want to be able to show early progress. You want to be able to speak to what's important to the agencies, and that's mission, right? Mission versus technical terms. A lot of times, you'll sit there and I see it all the time where, when I was in the government, where folks would come to me and they talk all the technical speak that they can because it's really cool stuff to, to techno geeks. And yeah, I'm sure it is, but that's not the thing that you're bringing up the chain. That's not the thing that you're putting forward. You want to solve problems. You don't want to have and sometimes and I'm a kind of a techno geek. Sometimes a pencil and paper is the best tool to solve a problem, not necessarily a big cray computer.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And so, and you're absolutely right that we should use the best tool for the job. And I do think that, for a lot of the reasons you spoke about, there's a lot of risk aversion in the government. Nobody wants to be on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times or something because of a bad decision they made. You know, like I'm just saw this morning that CISA is under pressure because of they didn't re I think release a telecom report, and they haven't in a while. How do you deal with that level of risk aversion in an organization, and when you're trying to like push forward things like new cutting edge technologies like AI, and how do you I'll start there.
And I know very specifically the one that you just brought up over at CISA, right? And that's a I think a great example of how politics gets into play, right? So, they've asked for that, ever since the current administration has come in office. They've been looking for that report from CISA. And what they're doing right now is they're holding that, and they did it for a while, in the first 90 days of the current administration, they're holding that because they wanted to get certain things through Congress, right? So Congress was holding it, not CISA wasn't holding it. When they were going through that, Congress was holding on to that carrot there. That okay, unless you give us this report, we're not going to put forward your director of CISA. So there's a few people that I know that are in the market, so to speak, or in the running for that director position, and that is very interesting because now it's come back up, and I noticed it yesterday kind of pop up again. It got quiet, but that's really one of the ways that you see where the politics does influence because when we get up in the morning and we're getting breakfast ready for ourselves or our family and this kind of stuff. That's the operational environment we have. If I was one of those, the huge kitchens that go over to disaster sites, their breakfast mission is a little bit different. And you kind of look at that same with the folks that are on the Hill. It's like, well, okay, there's something going over here and it impacts one little agency. But if I'm a senator or a congressman, I am looking at not only my congressional districts, but I'm also looking at the United States as a whole, and what's best for the United States, not what is best for John as I'm making scrambled eggs in the morning. I don't know if that makes sense. That's kind of an obscure, sometimes I make these things up on the fly and I'm like, where did that one come from? Right?
Absolutely, John. I make
Apparently
everything.
I'm hungry this morning, Nick. Okay.
I understand, man. And listen, I make everything up on the fly pretty much, so I understand. And I know just how that goes. And I think one of my favorite things that I've heard you say, not here yet, but you described bureaucracies and have described them as beautifully chaotic, which is just fantastic. But what are some of the biggest political headwinds that we see now, specifically around deploying AI responsibly?
Yeah, it's being able to remember allowing folks to really realize what AI is, right? I think that's one of the biggest challenges. I kind of go back to, if you look at your phone and your phone opens with your face, you're using the AI ML to be able to do that. Okay. Well, a couple of years back, the GPTs is what all of a sudden it's all over the news. You can type into the computer and it does some really cool stuff. So it made it more tangible for everyone. But if you go back and you look at AI ML, I mean, that's been around. You go back to the Dartmouth College, papers. You go back to Alan Turing and the Turing test. This stuff goes back into the 50s, and I think what's happening is that Moore's Law, right? That you're going to get more transistors onto a chipset, every 18 months or so, right? So it's one of those. It's happening even at a much greater pace within the AI community now. And as we can see, the entire world is putting all the world's dollars into being able to support that. Being able to kind of understand how do you push that forward within government space, you really have to look at it from, I'll always go back to what is the mission space for that? What are we trying to do? What are we trying to accomplish? A lot of times now that I'm on, in the GovCon space, It's yeah, I have that desire because, we might have some really cool technology that just does stuff that's really cool. But if I don't need that, if that doesn't improve what I'm trying to do, if that doesn't make my agency better for the public or delivering the mission that I'm supposed to do, and sometimes these missions, right, are life critical. I mean, you can go from, a challenge they had a while back when they released the healthcare.gov, right? I mean, there's all kinds of technical challenges. I'm not talking from a political perspective. I'm just talking when they released it, right? It kept crashing in the first couple of days, and you think, well, how can they let something like that happen? And a lot of times that's why in the government they will take extra time, do more due diligence, they'll have more barriers that are there. And they do that definitely within the AI space because right now, what do they say? It's kind of a black box. Not a lot of people really know what's going on the inside. But within government, the types of large language models, small language models, those types of things, those are definitely being tailored and trained for those specific government entities. But I think always start small. Start with small projects, get some quick wins in, and then start to get the rest of the agency to understand the value.
Absolutely. I, out of curiosity, how do you define AI personally?
I think that's a great question. And that should be something that you have a ready answer for, right? The funny thing is that, you can start looking at, what the books say and that type of stuff. My personal view is that, we have technology in whatever form factor it might be in, that it is assisting, with whatever the project or the task is that I have in hand, but it's assisting it at a greater speed, a greater clarity, hopefully greater accuracy to some degree. But I always look at it as number one, it's a tool. It's a tool to help me create, think, brainstorm, come up with ideas that maybe I did not realize. It's like, well, I did. So let me go down that path and see if that's actually fact or fiction, and kind of validate it and see that the information that it's given me is accurate.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that. That's a hard one for a lot of people to answer
Right.
concisely, because I think it's like it's largely a buzzword. And I think also, people don't, and like generative AI is cool. It's awesome. It's one of the shiny things, right?
Right. Yeah.
That's also like one, that's not all of AI. That's one very small piece of it. And I think
Exactly.
because that's in your face does not mean that, that other things aren't out there doing it, they just haven't been branded that way. Like, I mean, a great example I always think of is, Waze as you're driving, every day you're driving around, and it gives you a new route automatically to save you time based on current traffic conditions. That's AI, right? It's looking
Yeah.
constantly at all of the traffic out there, all the reports that we have, and then then it's rerouting you based on real-time data, right? That's absolutely 100% AI. And there's a whole lot of other applications and other use cases, like your phone, like on your social media. It's like an app, like they call it a social media algorithm. That algorithm is an AI that's feeding you what it thinks you want to see to keep you engaged and keep your attention locked. And that's been going on for a long, long time. And
Right.
I think that people also don't understand like the, width and breadth of what falls into AI and machine learning, right?
And you bring up a really good point as far as like everything being branded AI. 2 years ago, I flew down to Florida to see my kids for Christmas, right? And every time I go to Florida, I have a house, and every time I go down there, it's like, hey John, you're up in the DC area, you're kind of at the pulse of what's happening, and you're playing in the technology space. What's this AI thing? Is this going to be a big thing? Everybody's all excited going back a couple of years, right? And when I went down there, it was really funny. I don't know if you're familiar, but a couple of years ago, Coca-Cola, the company you're thinking of, has an AI Coke. The formula was created with artificial intelligence. It is branded that way. Go on Amazon, you can find it. That's where I got them. I bought several of them, of the cans. I have one at this moment in my fridge at the house. It literally, and it's a little miniature, you know, how they have those really small ones, like you have at a conference and that kind of stuff. And, you know, you read about it, you know, I think it might have been like, you know, AI 3000 Coca-Cola. And it's the darndest thing because everybody's like, ooh, ah, you know, and it's like, it's amazing how people just throw that label of AI on something as a marketing tool. Now, inside secret, you know, I love Coke. I drink, you know, Coke Zero is my favorite. I don't see it on camera, but that's my, the flavor that the AI came up with, it was terrible.
Sure. Sure. But
Now,
like
that's not AI's fault. It just happened to be the guy that selected that specific formula that the AI output had, right? You know?
Absolutely. But you know, like I've been like in, you know, Best Buy, for instance, and seen literally charging cables that have optimized for AI on them. And it's just like, I don't think you know what that means,
Right.
sir.
Yeah. The guys at marketing do, though, right? You know?
Absolutely, 100%, absolutely. But so out of curiosity, as somebody that worked in you know a lot of in the government environments a lot, what are some of the unwritten survival rules for managing up?
Unwritten survival rules for managing up. I think the first thing is no surprises, right? And that goes in a lot of components, right? So if we're talking about, you know, people that you know, have like a direct, you know, report to those types of things or that senior leader team, they don't want surprises, right? They want to, we talk about a topic, we bring up topics, this type of stuff. Nothing needs to, we don't have anything that comes out that they're not already briefed on. A good friend of mine, one of my mentors over the years, one of the things that she always did, and I learned this a lot of years ago, is let's pretend that, you know, there's going to be a meeting on Friday. And on Friday, it's a decision meeting. You know, a couple of the bosses will be there, that type of stuff. You need to pre-agree way before that meeting on the output or the answer to that meeting. So everyone that is a decision maker that goes into that meeting, they need to understand not just pre-reads, but they need to be on a, if you're shooting for a yes, they need to have already told you yes, you know, in a quiet, you know, hallway meeting or a casual meeting after another thing about what's coming up, that they're going to support that project or they're going to support that decision. You don't want folks to walk into a meeting, and those are meetings that I hate for whatever, you know, there's been times that I hadn't had time to do that, and there's this big debate, and all of a sudden everyone's looking at me. And it's like, well, what about all these other questions everybody's asking about? Why didn't you think about that? Why? And if I've already been able to mitigate the concerns that those other folks that are voting on something, because, you know, in the government, we have a lot of, you know, government technology boards and that type of stuff. And so I think that's a big one. No surprises. And I think an obvious one, bring solutions, not problems, right? So I think, you know, being able to survive and managing up, you don't want to, you know, hey, boss, this is, you know, you just don't go down to Best Buy and buy it. And if I stop there, then I haven't done my job. Here's where you do buy it, right? You know, you gotta have that solution of what that means and how that works. I think learning the personalities of the folks that we're dealing with is extremely important. I remember working with a leader one time that, you know, for a couple of years, and one of the values that he always came to me about was that, you know, John, you bring so much to the table. And what it was that this was not a technologist. This was a person that had been in the government for a long time, an amazing person, an amazing leader, but had to make decisions like, do I buy, you know, MRE food or blue tarps, or do I buy servers and laptops? Because that, you know, that individual was in that role that had to make those, you know, decisions on what to buy. And, you know, coming from technology, you know, I'm like, well, you got to buy servers and this kind of stuff. But in the role that he had me in and my team in, it was the idea of you bring us the ground truth. You know, can the server survive another week? What's the risk if they survive another year? Versus, okay, how many disasters we think that we're going to need food at over this next year? And just kind of bring that ground truth. So I think that's a big one as far as learning the personalities, because it's not just about the org chart, right? Where a person sits on the org chart, of course, has, you know, that formal, you know, aspect of it, but it's not necessarily the entire picture. And I think the last one I would say is that, who owns that informal control, right? I mean, we've all been in the conference rooms where, you got the guy at the end of the table, but the guy at the end of the table, is kind of sitting quiet and is looking at the guy over here, just kind of waiting. Is this a head nod up and down or a left and no, to really see who controls those opportunities and those decision points.
Yeah, no, I love that because I completely agree. You have to understand, you got to prep people before. Anytime I go into like a pitch, where I'm pitching anything, I tell them, I tell you what I'm going to tell you, then I tell you, and then I tell you what I told you, right? And I expect to have a yes before I even walk into that room because of groundwork you've done. And I always tell my people the same thing. It's like, that's fine if you have a problem, but like come up with an idea or a couple of ideas of a solution. We can talk about it and brainstorm about it, but don't just bring me a problem full stop unless it's something you really can't solve and you don't know how to, and then ask, hey, how should we go about solving this together, as opposed to pointing fingers and making somebody, and like putting all the responsibility back on me, right? So I absolutely love that. And
Yeah,
I go
and
ahead.
Nick, it's interesting, right? What you and I are talking about and sharing today, this isn't, brain surgery, right? I mean, does it fit with in an era that we were building steam engines? Yeah. Does it fit in an era that we're talking about technology, AI, ML, that type of stuff? It does. So, and I think a lot of times people are like, well, if this is technology and AI, we have to just totally redo how we up brief our bosses or how we manage up or manage. Not necessarily, right? Get back to some of the basics.
Yeah, no, and one of the things that like I'm a big history fan of history, John. I think I
Okay.
told you that.
You told me that, right?
One of the things that the reason I love it is that like people are people are people. It doesn't matter if you're talking about somebody that lived 2,500 years ago, 500 years ago, or today. The social construct around them is, going to be a little different, or very different. The societal constructs around them are very different. But I firmly believe if you took a kid from, call it 1,000 years ago, and brought them here as an infant, they would grow up just like somebody grows up today. They're not fundamentally different because people are people are people. And I think that one of the things that technologists lose sometimes is the people in the process, right? I think that that's the most important thing. To your point about mission sets, the only reason you need technology is to solve people problems, right? Or do them more
Right.
efficiently or faster, or take it from a different approach. The reason that like AI is cool is not because it can like generate images for you. It's because it can help you solve problems faster and help you think about things in different ways, right? And so, that's really kind of my approach is like, how do we bring and how do we serve people with these products?
Right.
Can't
That
lose.
makes so much sense. That's perfect. Yep.
Absolutely. And so, how do you keep innovation alive without, stepping on toes or getting buried in oversight?
In oversight. So let's start with that. I think oversight can be a strong advocate, within all different environments, right? Whether that's at a small company or a large government entity, there's going to be some type of oversight, right? As a parent, I'm oversighting my kids when they were young. I mean, it goes to all levels. I believe that if you can get those entities, those people, those teams that will have different levels of oversight involved with your projects early and get them understanding what you're trying to accomplish, they will see if they're involved with it early, not at the very last end. They'll see all the work, all the process that has been put in place and why decisions have been made. And I think I like to bring those folks that are in the oversight roles to be able to be part of that team. They can help shield, others. They can help, support what's going on because, cybersecurity is an example, right? I mean, a lot of times people, okay, we did it all. Now we just got to get an ATO to get it on the network. And cyber's like, I haven't heard about this project. How do you want me? How am I supposed to approve this? And what kind of work have you done? It's like, we've been working on it for 6 months or 2 years. I also think being able to share credit, right? Without, talking about not stepping on folks' toes, sharing the credit, not going in and say that, hey, I'm John, large and in charge, and I'm going to do this entire thing here. If If the goal is that mission outcome, then let's get the right players in the room. Let's let everyone have ownership on it. Let's let everyone take the credit for the great work that's being done. Make them stakeholders. Put them, and it does a couple of things. It allows the folks to that maybe, and I've seen this a couple of times where a certain component within an agency, well, gosh, they've never asked me for my input, and I'm like, well, I'm asking you to have a seat at the table. And then they're all excited, and they're little taskers after each meeting. They come back with, quick and quality and those types of things. So, I think that's one way that I like to use it to not step on folks' toes and not really get, buried in the oversight and not having too much people that are causing issues.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love the focus on inclusivity around responsibility and bringing looping people in early, and then giving them the opportunity to take credit for the successes as well, not just you. I think that when people are working together without a desire for, without a desire for credit, or you're removing ego from when you can remove ego from the decision making process, I think that's a win for everybody.
I agree. 100%.
Absolutely. And can you give us some an example or two where success of an AI project depended more on diplomacy than data?
So, that's an interesting question. We're dependent more on diplomacy than data. I guess the one that kind of comes to mind is, obviously this was, in government, without sharing a lot of details on it, but there's a tool that is used, and it used to be paper and pencil, that allowed the president, when he would go through and be under consideration for an emergency declaration for a disaster. So, the traditional process, the governor of a state has something that has happened. They're not able to take care of that. They put together a request. It goes through a lot of different processes before the agency, in this case FEMA, makes that recommendation to the president that yes, this qualifies and you should consider it, or no, this doesn't qualify and we recommend not. And of course, when the president, signs the form or signs the paper, then billions of dollars potentially is at the disposal of the agency to execute on that presidential decision. So there's a lot of politics that come into that. There's a ton of it. And I'll be honest with you, that originally that was pencil and paper. There was a big packet that, okay, this is what the governor, as an example, or a chief of a tribal nation, that type of stuff, people that have that authority to ask. It was a packet. I mean, literally would go from one desk to the other. People would read it and people would sign the little thing or not sign it, or give their recommendations throughout an agency. It was like there had to be a better way, right? So my boss came to me one day and he's like, I mean, literally, he had his phone in his hand. This was on a Monday morning, and he says, he's like, "Hey, let me show you some stuff." And it was him and his kids. And I'm like, "Oh, that's really cute. That kind of stuff. You guys have a good weekend." And he said, "Yeah." And then I start looking at the image of his kids or behind his kids. And as I'm scrolling through that, and it's his office. And I'm realizing that it was a Sunday that he's in his office with his kids. And I start, a little bit of conversation there, and then I realize what the pain point was. And the pain point was, why did he have to come into the office to sign a piece of paper, on a Sunday when his kids and this type of stuff, when, you and I can sign a gym membership online. Hell, we can sign a mortgage online. But for some reason, the process at that time required him to get in his car, drive all the way down to the office, and kids in tote. So as we started going through that process, I'm like, all right, I know your pain point, right? Now I know what the pain point is, and now I know what this task, what this mission task is that that you want me to take on. So all right, I got it, boss. Well, it sounds easy, right? That well, okay, we just automate the process of how this stuff goes back and forth. But the data that was in there was very specific data. It's data that's not under the Freedom of Information Act, right? So it's not FOIable. There's people's pure comments in things. There is information that's not required to be publicly shared or not allowed to be publicly shared. And this whole process goes through the National Security Council. So it goes through the NSC. And as we were going back and forth, How did we deal with that issue of the data? It was important for us to show that the data was secure. And again, it's going from one system to another system to another system. It's not like it's all in the same, envelope, so to speak, within a certain network environment. It was multiple networks that had to talk to each other and at different levels of classification. And how did we deal with it from a diplomacy way? Because people were like, hey, wait a minute, you're sharing state data in a federal system, and we're a state, it's like, well, I'm from the Commonwealth of Virginia and this is Virginia data and it doesn't meet our data requirements or something. And it's like, I mean, yes, there's the, and you go back to that, right? Where you have, states, going and talking about their ability to be independent states, right? The United States, so there's a lot of data problems there. So the way that we did that was we made sure that we showed that it was very clear of how we did it. We got everybody involved, the stakeholders that were appropriately involved there, built the trust. And yeah, I think trust and relationships is much more important than algorithms and models. And that's really the way that we dealt with the diplomacy of that was the relationships. And of course, the political timing, of course, sometimes changes is how you manage some of that, but it boils down to the trust and relationships.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's interesting that they had to come into the office and like actually physically sign the piece of paper. And I know that there's a lot of e-sign solutions. However, I know that a lot of their servers are not in this country. They can be elsewhere overseas. And then as data moves in and out of the country, that's a no-no. You can't move National Security Council data out of the country and then back in because of who might pick it up or grab it. And so I know that it just becomes very, very complex as far as how do you actually build a solution where you have where your data stays in the country and you could actually have it all stay there, as opposed to moving around overseas. So I can imagine that was technically complex.
Yeah, Nick, you're just so spot on. Were you on the program? Because you're so spot on that, right? 100%. And of course, the first thing I thought about was going to that one company that everybody knows and, ask that kind of thing. And it's like, well, what do you mean your servers are out of the country? And it's like, hey, well, can you build us a section that stays in the country? And they're like, well, how many people are going to use it? I said, well, about 100 people, but all the way from the president and the NSC. And they're like 100 people, it's like, no, you're not a big enough customer. And it's like, but we're the government, So, Nick, if you go back, I mean, there was an era, right, when everybody was using BlackBerries, within the federal government. And at that time, all the BlackBerry servers were in Canada. So that's one of the reasons that a lot of the federal government got, off of that space and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think you must have been listening in on those conversations. You're spot on, buddy.
Listen, I can neither confirm nor deny, John.
There you
never, but yeah, man. So, go ahead. Did you have something to add to that?
No, yeah, I'm good.
All right, awesome, man. So, one thing that I was very curious about is I know you were at FEMA for 14 years, and you were in public service before that as well. And I know that there's a large adjustment when you move out of the government into industry. What are some of the biggest, what are some of the biggest mindset shifts that you had to go through as you moved from public service to private industry?
Yeah, so in public service, you look at stability. You look at and when I'm talking, we'll talk about technology. We'll talk about that mindset of how staff works, that type of stuff. So you want to have programs, and I mean programs not in a technical sense, but programs that work for the for our constituents, programs that are providing services to the community. To the taxpayers and doing it where you're not just jacking things up all the time and making things that okay, well, let's just try this and if it crashes, don't worry about it. Because the we expect, right, that when we log into, I mean, you name it, whatever, irs.gov or whatever, that the website's going to be there, that when I type the stuff in, it's going to work and I'm not going to have any challenge. It might not be the smoothest thing, it might be a little slow, but at least I'm going to be able to work my way through it. So in government, I kind of look at it as stability. In industry, I kind of look at it as that it's all about speed and growth. And that's and those two are not necessarily, that doesn't really play well in the government. Speed, of course, we all like to say that we want things faster. We all like to say that we want to improve, the services that we give to the community. But in the industry, the rewards come from that speed, that innovation. And of course, industry is all about growth, right? If you have a company and they sold $500 million in business in 1 year, and if the next year it's $500 million, the same dollar amount, that company is getting smaller because inflation, right? So you need to do $550 million just to, in essence, kind of break even because of inflation things. So, and I think that's something that you don't think about when you're on the inside. You don't think about the urgency the private sector has, especially around revenue growth. I will say there's, and one of the reasons that I'm with the company that I'm with now, with Titan Technologies, is the fact that they, of course, it's a business, and of course, we need to make money, and we need to do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. But at the same time, they understand the importance of the mission set, the importance of serving the community. It's very red, white, and blue. And I'll tell you, that's one of the things that really touched me for me to be able to reach out and start working with them, is that they actually had that. And I didn't see that all the time in the government, right? I would have people coming to me, even a company is on a contract with me, and I'm spending millions of dollars on this contract with this company, and it happens all the time, where all of a sudden they're like, "Hey, we got this this special add-on, and this add-on is going to allow such and such, and it's going to cost $1 million, whatever." And always trying to upsell you, always trying to. It's like, well, what value does that bring to the mission? Well, it doesn't, but it sure makes it look shiny. And it's like, and I'm not looking for that. I'm, and that's one of the things that, there are companies out there, believe it, and you and your company being one of them, right, that actually believes in helping America, helping the mission set, being able to support that entity, that agency, or that company that supports an agency, do the right thing, and to be able to, because at the very end of the day, yes, I mean, whether we work for the government or work for industry, we're still part of the United States, and the services that these companies are doing are services that you and I interact with on a daily basis, whether that's down at the Department of Motor Vehicles, right? And those types of things. So I think that's one of the biggest things that I kind of see, is the stability component versus the speed and growth.
Absolutely. Is there, do you notice a significant difference in managing up in private sector versus public sector?
I do, right? I think in the private sector, in the government sector, being able to manage up, there's a lot of formality that's in play. Just like in the military, everybody has rank. When you are in a traditional federal civilian government space, you are in an area where they actually do have rank. There's a very defined, there's a pay structure, so that's equivalent to a rank structure. In industry, one of the things that I notice as far as being able to manage up, I think it's more important to be able to manage, who are the decision makers, and who are the influencers, who are the folks that are actually going to help drive a decision. Because, in the government, I never really had to worry about, well, I wonder what marketing thinks, or I wonder what, our chief growth officer is going to think, right? And what is our revenue share on something? Industry, you have to think of those things, and so that means that you have different folks that have different, influence on either something that you're trying to support, a mission set you're trying to accomplish, technology that you're trying to build, or a direction of technology that you want your team to go with.
Absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot more, I mean, there's different complexities in the government than there are in industry. And I would say that I don't know if they're equally complex. I think that depends on the size of the private company you're with, right? I'm sure like at Amazon, it's going to be very similar to a governmental structure because of just the size of the
The
company
size of it, right? Yeah.
and the inertia associated with that. But I would also assume that, mid-market and smaller companies, there's probably less, but you or less players involved. But it's just as important to manage expectations because I feel like that's what most of managing up is setting expectations and managing expectations.
I agree with you. And especially in technology, you need to set those expectations. I look at it that, government is mission, and industry I hate to say it, but is money. And I don't mean that in a bad way, right? If pick one of the Big Ten, right? If they're going to launch satellites and space and this kind of stuff, they have to be able to fund that. They have to be able to. And at the end of the day, you and I are getting Netflix because and telephone calls because there's satellites in space, right? So those companies that money component, is very important to them. Of course, they have shareholders and those types of things. I get that. But government mission first with government, I think. And anybody that's in the industry that's trying to sell the government anything or try to help the government do anything, industry has to, you have to talk in mission sets. You don't have to, and some of that mission set could be where a tool, a widget, a shiny object, whatever can bring better value, right? It could maybe make things speed to market on something, or being able to actually help decrease a cost so they can use their limited dollars in the government. And government has limited dollars to be able to put on another project or to fix something else that now that you've saved them. It's like they've said, okay, it's going to cost $1 million. You've been able to do it faster, cheaper, smarter, for half a million. Now they have some dollars that they can reappropriate within that agency to work on something else.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that one of the things that I wish more people in business, thought about is, like, to me, money is a result, right? It's a result of a delivered good or service. I'm going to deliver something to you that, maybe you need it, maybe you don't. And it's like, it doesn't matter if it's like, IT services or a blanket or something. You're buying something because it solves a problem for you as a person. And
Right.
I think it's like, as a business owner, my approach is, how do we solve mission critical problems and understand that if we, position ourselves properly and do it properly, there is the result of that is money, right? I think that p business owners who prioritize money over everything else will always end up with an inferior product because they're gonna, or an inferior results because they are always like, because money is everything to them. That's all they're looking for. I think that that colors and changes how you interact with everybody and how you move through the world.
That's a good point. What's the old saying? That's like, you run across something that some company has made and it breaks. I'm talking like consumer products or something like that. What's the first thing we say? It's like, man, we can put a man on the moon, but we can't get this little cap to quit breaking on my water bottle, right? But somebody had to make that, make or buy decision on how much engineering and how much plastic's gonna go in that little cap, and they realized that, well, not everybody's gonna spend $100 for a bottle of water. So I get it. That makes a lot of sense, Nick.
Absolutely. What lessons from public service still guide you in business development and leadership today?
Clearly, it's going to be understanding and have empathy for the frontline workers. The people that are out there doing the job. So many times, we see, and I think we see it a lot more recently, is that people are demonizing the federal employees and the public service folks that are just doing the job. In all the years that I was in the government, all the years that I had very, senior leadership type positions, there's very few times that I've ever been able to change the direction of the battleship, right? Very few people have that ability. So the people that most of the time in the government, in the GovCon space that we're working with at a government agency, are folks that they're not changing the direction of the battleship. They've been told because somebody else got told, because somebody else got told that they have to solve a problem. And they're coming to industry to say, can you solve this problem? And for, and if we don't think about what those frontline workers are doing, those frontline teams, we've kind of lost a lot there. I think that also understanding that they have constraints, going back to that battleship. As we've all, I've always did this. Many a times I've walked out of a meeting and it's like, man, I tell you, I think we should go this direction. But for some reason, the agency keeps going in this direction, right? But very few people have that ability to change the direction of that battleship, right? You might have 20,000 people in an agency, and you might have two of them that can change the direction of the battleship. And that's only after they've talked to the White House. So, and I'm talking through all administrations. So understanding that those constraints that the folks are working with, I would have loved to, okay, have vendors come in and it's like, I want that product, But one of the constraints that I would have is that I would have to get cybersecurity to buy in on it, right? I would have to get the contracting officer to buy in on it. It's like, well, you want to buy, Microsoft Word, but what about, Word Perfect? Aging myself here, right? But it's like, it's like, well, we have to talk to them too. And it's like, well, that makes no sense or what, but that's the operational constraints that the government employees are working in. And I recognize recently a lot of that has been upturned, where folks might come in and just say, throw all the rules, laws, regulations out the door. We're going to do it this way because that makes sense to that person. That's great, but it also has things that are broken. And those things that are broken can have very significant impact, especially when you're dealing with PII, when you're dealing with healthcare data, right, on individuals. I mean, we want to make things, faster and those kind of things. But at the same time, do we want all of our private information to be shared because something was done so quickly? All of a sudden, our data is now, not that it already isn't, but our data is all over the internet, right? So I think understanding the frontline teams that are out there and understanding the operational constraints that they're working in, I think
Absolutely.
that's a real big one for private sector to keep remembering, because you can walk out of there and say, man, just do it this way. It's going to work fine. And it's like, no, I got to get six signatures, not five. I got to get six. I didn't make the rules up. I'm going to try to make things better. One day, if I can get something a little better, every day at the office, those are those short wins that at the end going to help.
Absolutely. How do you deal with folks that that like view AI as magic?
Oh yeah, well, and there's a lot of people that do, right? That they just think that it's just all of a sudden it's all going to happen. I think what I try to do is I kind of let them experiment with, right? And I think especially if it's going to be a big influencer on a project or an opportunity that we're working on, is be able to allow them to actually touch, smell, feel what they think is AI, which of course is going to be a GPT of some sort. But let them understand that, I mean, is there times to use your example on having, the GPS gets you from point A to point B? It happens to be in my current car that I have a built-in navigation system, but I also have a navigation system on my phone too. And there's been many a times that I have them both running and they're taking me two different directions. And they both had the same arrival time. And one of them has a traffic accident, the other one does not. There's technology that has, that definitely has issues. And being able to allow folks to realize that it's not magic. It's ones and zeros. It's really cool. I mean, there's no question about it. Especially in the generative side of things, but allowing them to realize that that there's people that were behind this. There's real. I watched a special the other day on Curiosity. I don't know if you've seen the Curiosity Stream channel. It's a really good. It's only like $4 a month.
Nice.
Discovered it on my Apple TV thing. And they're always talking about new technology, which is really cool. And they do have a lot of history in there too. And I know you like history.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out.
It, yeah, it, it, there's an episode and they were talking about, that there's actual hardware in this cloud, and they were just kind of showing the cloud, it's not just not really some cloud thing up there. There's actual electricity and there's, ones and zeros and chips and GPUs and, those kind of things. Now, of course, in this area that we both kind of live here within the Loudoun County area, we realize this is data capital of the world, for the all the data centers. But it was interesting, and I think that's one way to kind of remind folks that it's not magic.
Yeah, I completely agree. And seeing the infrastructure that supports all of this, I mean, you and I see it in ways that most people don't because of the proliferation of data centers right here. So,
Yep.
but also, most people don't really know what a data center is, I don't think. Truthfully, I don't think that most people really know how the internet actually works either. So I don't know, it's really interesting. So, but John, what inspired you to write Bots and Bosses, and why do you approach AI leadership through comedy?
Yeah, it's my daughter calls it, dad humor, right? And I think what I wanted to do is I wanted to so I've written a lot of books on technology. And one of the things that I try to do is have that level of humor that's in there. I believe that it allows to kind of break down some barriers. I jokingly say you can read all the books. It's not going to teach you AI because that's not my point. My point is to allow you to understand being able to manage up, manage down, manage laterally. Understand that, there's stuff behind this. But I think if it was, just pure dry, ones and zeros type of a book, that's, that no one's going to like that. And it allows you to kind of put your guardrails down. And allows you to look at it can be funny, right? I mean, some of the things that we've all experienced, and all of a sudden it's like, I'm on a road and it says that, you need to stop because the road's not there. And I'm like, well, this, I-95's been there for a lot of years. I'm on 95. And now the technology is telling me I got to stop because the road's not there. It does silly things, right? So if we can kind of approach it from that perspective that, it is going to cause silly aspects of things to happen. And I think being able to have that dad humor in it just it's just something a little bit different for me, I guess, is that's how I kind of decided to approach that.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you. I think that one of the things that I always tell my team and tell folks that I'm mentoring and talking to is that what you say has a lot less is a lot less important than how you say it. If you're not presenting your message in a way that somebody can receive it and understand it and bring it like and integrate it into themselves, you're just wasting your time. Right. You have to make sure that you're putting your messaging together in very palatable ways for folks so that they understand, so that they will even listen to you and be open to it. And I think like I use humor that way all the time.
I think that's perfect too. And that what do they call that? Self-degrading humor, that kind of stuff where you can make fun
Oh,
of
definitely.
yourself. And I love to do that too, right? I mean, because I screw up every single day, right? So I got examples left and right when I'm talking to somebody about it. And I think that's great. It makes you approachable, makes it real. And we're all gonna have those funny little things that are gonna kind of happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. One side note, one of the things I always like to do is find the people that are overly serious about themselves and poke fun at them and just see what happens. Because
Right.
if your ego can't handle that, then we're not going to be friends.
I copy that for sure.
Absolutely, man. What myths, what management myths keep repeating as AI, is entering every boardroom?
Yeah, and I think one of them is the obvious, right? That AI is going to take over my job. And is that a myth? Is that some facts? Well, it's going to change. It's going to change. There was an era that we did not, on assembly lines for cars, we had humans doing the welding, right? And all of a sudden now we have the robotics that does the welding. Is it going to change? Were there folks that were doing welding that, no longer had the job they currently had? Yeah, that's true. Is it over time going to be changing, right? And we all have heard, the concept of being able to upskill. And I've been able to experience that with staff that have worked for me, where, when I'm in the government at the time and we were changing types of technology, not necessarily to AI, but if you change from one kind of a software to a different kind of a software, the magic behind it, so to speak, doesn't matter if it's AI or not, you still have to learn this new software and how to apply it and how it works and being able to use. And I remember multiple examples where everybody's like, but I'm so used to doing it this way and using it this way. And it's like, well, let's talk through this. Let's see, number one, why are we going to go this way, right? Why are we going to use this new tool? How can I get you upskilled in this? Meaning that, okay, do we need to go back to some very basics of computers? Do we need to have different multiple courses? Do we need to allow you to break things? Yes, give them a sandbox so they can get into a sandbox and figure things out, and what they break, they just hit the reset button and do it some more before they go into live production system. I think that that's certainly one thing. And I think that, another kind of myth that I see is that, you just set it and forget it, right? So it's like, AI is going to, do all my calendaring for me and I never have to look at it again. Not necessarily true, right? You don't just set it and forget it. You need to understand that, it's not fully self-managing. It needs that human in the loop that we all talk about. And that, there's that concept of, myths of how it's going to change culture. And that's a real interesting one.
I agree completely.
Because it Does it change? Of course it does, right? I jokingly, I talk with my daughter and it's like, yeah, I noticed that, you were posting some stuff on Instacart. And she says, Dad, that's Instagram. So it's like, so it does change how the culture works. It changes how, those types of things. And I think the other myth that I see a lot of that is that the more data we have, then the better the decision. And there's not a one-to-one on that, right? You can, in technology, specifically with AI, you can give it too much information to where it's not able to actually figure out what you're asking for. Maybe you haven't done decent prompt engineering. Maybe the API between one system and the other just can't handle that quantity of data that goes back and forth. So those are a couple that I see. I'm sure you see some as well.
Absolutely. No, I absolutely do. I also think that prompt engineering is very, very important in f figuring out how you ask for things. But also, I think one of the things that people don't understand truthfully is that AI applications is that's like the last 5% of your data infrastructure, right? And it's only as good as the underlying data infrastructure that you have. And if you because if you feed AI a whole bunch of garbage data, you're going to get garbage output because it's only as good as your data is, right? And so if you're able to have a strong foundation of excellent data infrastructure, your house is going to be very, your AI house is going to be very stable and secure. But if you don't have the right infrastructure underneath it, like you're just doing, more stupid things faster.
Yeah, that I was just gonna say that, right? And all of a sudden, the output you got, excuse me, it's a lot faster. That doesn't mean that it has value, that it's accurate. Spot on, yeah.
Absolutely. If AI were an employee at a government agency, how would it handle its own performance review?
If AI were an employee, I would look at it kind of as a like an intern. Right. So here you have, something that can do things faster, something that can look through a lot more data than maybe that, a regular human is not going to be able to go through all the input on that. What they're going to do with that information, they're going to be able to create a report or an output, that is like amazingly strong and so believable when you read it. But at the same time, like any intern that you have on an evaluation is like, now I have to spend the time to kind of see where did the that intern get that information? How correct is that information? So, we always kind of see, especially in the NCR, National Capital Region, right? All of these staffers that work for the, everybody is like, oh, we're gonna stay up till 4 a.m. in the morning getting this thing done, and you really wonder, well, what is that output? Was the output really what the ask was, and was it accurate? So I think it's a similar. I see that correlation between an AI employee and an intern.
Absolutely. How do you maintain your optimism and creativity when bureaucracy feels unbreakable?
Yeah, I think the ability to celebrate small wins is important. That ability to have humor with your team and realize that, oh my gosh, how did we miss this thing, right? Being able to understand that you want to have forward movement. You'll never, what's that, you want to get a, 80%, right? It's like if we spend all the time to make something perfect, we're never going to go to production with it. We're never going to use it. But if we can get something that is reasonable, and we have been able to share what the risk is, we've been able to remind folks of how they can mitigate what those risks are. I think those kind of things and those small wins and continuing to kind of keep it moving. And it's like, okay, hey, we talked about solving world hunger. Yesterday we were able to feed one person. So, we're starting there. We didn't feed all of world hunger, but we're starting to get there.
Yeah, one of my it's I think it's an ancient Egyptian saying that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, right? You got to start somewhere. And
Right.
if you don't start anywhere, then I mean you'll never get there, right? Even if the progress feels small, even if it's incremental, that's absolutely the case. I completely agree with you.
Yeah, it's kind of like weight loss, right? All of a sudden it's like, oh, I want to lose 25 pounds. And all of a sudden I wake up tomorrow and I haven't lost 25 pounds. Maybe I lost a half a pound, right? Maybe I'll go for a longer walk tomorrow, right?
100%. And like, people, I think people also forget that lifestyle, right? your life, like your small, the small things that you do on a day-to-day basis, create your lifestyle overall. And so, there's always that definition of insanity that you hear that, it's the doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And I've always hated that, right? Like I flipped it around in my head, is that if you want different results tomorrow, start making changes today.
There you go.
Yeah,
That's
absolutely.
a t-shirt. That's a t-shirt, Nick.
Oh man, I had a t-shirt moment, man. I
Right.
don't need another
Damn.
business
You
job.
know, draw some powers, right?
Absolutely, man. Man, my last question for you is,
Excuse me.
what gives you hope about the next generation of leaders that you see coming up now that you've mentored and helped train?
Yeah, I think, especially as it evolves with technology and AI and those types of things, I see that they're more data literate, right? They understand the importance of data. Back to our conversation, garbage in, garbage out. I think they're more collaborative. They understand that, that ability to work together. I think they understand the importance of working together and that collaboration. And I think they're also open to, changing, from, legacy systems, the way we've always done it to, hey, let's do it this way now. Let's see what this works. Does this different direction, this different process, this different tool, does that allow us to maybe have a better impact on what the results are going to be? And I think they would probably be looking at it too as, AI as a team member, not a threat. A lot of times I think the folks that look at AI as a threat are the folks that might be in a position to where their abilities to be upskilled are not there. We look at generations, there's those times and generations where a telephone, was attached to the wall, and then you had this long cord, and then it got to where there was no cord, and you had this little metal thing you pulled out. There's and we've all kind of grown up in different times. And the current generations, they won't know what it's like living before 9/11, right? Current generations, they won't know what it's like to live before AI, right? Because that's what they've been brought up in. So I think there's a lot of hope there. And I think that, the ability to understand, these very specific moving parts that come into play when it comes to technology, when it comes into play with AI and ML, I think there's a lot of hope there, and there's a lot of talent. My gosh, a lot of the folks that the books that I read, the podcasts that I listen to, these kind of things, they're young folks. They're future generations that are coming through. And I know, a lot of the leaders. I have a good friend of mine over at Google, and literally like 2 days ago, he was talking to not a high school, it was like a junior high school group at a school over in West Virginia, and it was like they were just listening and understanding the possibilities of, for them to get skills that would be appropriate for the future, and how they can help shape the future for society. Because what do they say? You're growing up, any one of you can be an astronaut or a president, that kind of thing. And there's a lot of hope, I think, for the future.
I'm right there with you. I tend to be an optimist about things. I also am a realist about other things, and I think that there's a lot of significant challenges we need to overcome over the next, call it 10 to 15 years in a lot of ways. But I think that I think we can do it. I think it's gonna be fun. We've overcome them all before. So
Right. Yep.
we have a humanity has a pretty good track record, I think. It's gonna be really interesting to see. John, anything, did I miss anything? Anything, any additional points you'd like to make? Anything I forgot to ask you?
Yeah, no, I think it was a great conversation today, and I certainly, welcome folks to provide feedback and reach out to me, all over LinkedIn, that type of stuff, and happy to have the conversations about anything technology or anything, to be honest with.
Awesome. I really appreciate you coming on, John. Thanks. I also really enjoyed our conversation. Had a lot of fun. Everybody out there, thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape. I hope you're having a wonderful day.